right, next up, running sort of back down the food web, Greg Pelletier is here. He's going to talk to us about hypoxia and ocean acidification kinds of things, because he comes to us as an environmental engineer from the Environmental Assessment Program at the Washington State Department of Ecology, and he works on a variety of water quality modeling studies, including biogeochemical models to address hypoxia and ocean acidification here in Puget Sound.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you. About 10 years ago, we started a project to make a computer model of the Salish Sea for dissolved oxygen, nutrients, and phytoplankton. In the last few years, we've also added the capability to predict acidification. And right now, we're working on a project of using the model to see what it can tell us about the vulnerability of organisms that are sensitive to acidification. And I'm going to be presenting information from that most recent study today related to two organisms that are shown in the picture on this slide. The top picture is early life stage of Dungeness crab called Megalope. They're very tiny. They're about the size of a pencil eraser, and they swim freely in the water. And then the other organism we'll talk about is a pteropod, which is a tiny sea snail, which swims freely in the water also and is an important food source for salmon and other fish. Over the 10 years we've been doing this project, there have been a lot of technical reports and journal articles and presentations made that talk about things like the model calibration and the setup and the equations and how well does the model match predictions and observations. And I'm not going to go over that, but all these reports are available on this website at PNNL. The model development's been led by Tarang Kangankar at PNNL, and he's put all these this kind of information at this website that you can go to this link if you want to find out more about that. We use two model scenarios to evaluate the effect of nutrient inputs. The first model scenario is just the realistic conditions during the year 2008. That's our model calibration year. And we call that existing condition or baseline. And then the other scenario is a hypothetical condition of the same thing as existing conditions, except we back out all of the human nutrient sources. And that would include wastewater treatment plants, non-point sources from rivers. And then we run the model under that hypothetical scenario. And we compare these two scenarios and take the difference between them. That tells us the effect of the additional nutrient sources from human activities. The top 30 meters of the water column is the zone where there's enough light for algae to grow. We call that the euphotic zone. April through September is the season when it's most favorable for phytoplankton to grow, or call that the growing season. And nitrogen's the limiting nutrient. What this map is showing is what the model's predicting for what's the percentage of dissolved inorganic nitrogen in the euphotic zone in the growing season that we can attribute to human nutrient sources. And what we see is up to about 30% of the DIN, which is the form that the algae use, is coming from human nutrient sources. Widespread areas where it's 10 to 15%. In other words, if not for those additional human nutrient sources, the DIN would be that much less. A question that's really often asked is, what's the importance of the ocean in providing nitrogen, loading nitrogen into the system? And usually the question is that the ocean is so large that other sources, like human sources, must be insignificant. And if you look out at the entrance of Strait of Juan de Fuca, you know, the model and the data there show that, you know, only about 1% or less of the nitrogen that's in the water there is from human sources. It is 99%+ from the ocean. But as you go farther inland to places like South Puget Sound, you know, the human nutrient sources aren't the major nutrient source, but they are relatively more significant and up in the range of about 10 to 15% over most of South Puget Sound. So the additional nutrient source results in additional growth of phytoplankton. And what this map is showing is what's the percentage of the phytoplankton biomass during the growing season that we can attribute to those human nutrient sources. In other words, up to about 12% of the phytoplankton biomass is because of that additional human nutrient load. Not as much of a high percentage as for the DIN. There are other things that limit the algae growth. When the algae grow and they produce organic carbon, and they, when they die, that settles to the bottom. And then what this map is showing is what's the percentage of total organic carbon on the bottom that we can attribute to human nutrient sources. And we're back up to about as much as 30% of the total organic carbon in the bottom layer of the water is attributable to human nutrient sources, and about 10 to 15% over widespread areas. The excess algae production isn't the only source of organic carbon. There's also a river loading of organic carbon that contributes to this. And organic carbon is really important because when it decomposes, that's what leads to hypoxia and acidification. So now I want to show some results for the crab megalope, and they're present in the months of May and June. And what they're sensitive to is the gradient of pH in the water column, which is the difference in pH between at the surface and at a depth of 30 meters. And the larger this gradient is, the more likely their shells are to dissolve, which can affect their survival. And what we're seeing in South Puget Sound is pH gradients of up to about 0.5 units. In other words, pH on the surface is up to about 0.5 units higher than pH at about 30 meters down. So these dark blue areas would be the areas where there's the most severe stress for crab shells dissolving because of this pH gradient. Up to about 0.1 pH units of that gradient is attributable to the human nutrient sources. In other words, the map I showed previously would be reduced by about 0.1 units if not for the presence of the human nutrient sources. And the you can see, again, the dark blue areas would be the areas where the human nutrient sources have the most impact on increasing that pH gradient. The scientists who are studying this relationship between crabs dissolving, they call it crab dissolution, and pH gradient have come up with a linear equation, probably, I think, based on a regression analysis. If we put the information in the previous maps into that equation, what we can see is that the severity of crab dissolution attributable to human sources amounts to as much as 15% of the total stress from that that process. And, you know, somebody in a morning session asked the question about the collapse of the Dungeness crab population, and this is something that may be relevant to that. You know, we're not saying that this is the cause of the collapse, but for a population that's stressed by multiple things and in a state of collapse, this is this additional stress from increasing dissolution is not going to help the situation. Next, I want to talk about some results for pteropods. Pteropods are sensitive to what's called the aragonite saturation state. And aragonite is a form of calcium carbonate that their shells are made out of. And there's this number that we call omega, which is the saturation state number. And the lower this omega number is, the more likely their shells are to dissolve. And there's various life history stages of pteropods that we're looking at. The one I'm going to show you is for egg development during the spawning period that occurs in September. During this, for egg development, the threshold for omega is if it goes below a value of 0.9 for more than 2 days, that would be considered an adverse event that's not favorable for egg development. And what we see in this map is during the month of September, when there should be the second spawning period for pteropods, there are widespread areas where for the entire 30 days of September, the conditions are below the threshold of 0.9, so adverse with respect to egg development. And then I want to call your attention to other areas like Bud Inlet, where it's only for maybe a few days or a week. In those areas, what the next map is showing is how much of the severity of those adverse events for egg development is attributable to human nutrient sources. And what we see is that up to 100% of the severity could be attributed to human nutrient sources in those places like Bud Inlet, where it's only adverse for a few days or a week. What the model is telling us is that if not, if those human nutrient sources weren't present, then that condition would not occur. So the occurrence, the additional human nutrient sources are spreading the area where the adverse events occur, and also the duration and the intensity of those events. And even in areas where we saw that the you know, the dark blue areas on the previous map where the entire 30 days was adverse, the additional nutrients deepens the amount below the omega threshold that that the conditions occur, and increases the severity there also. So in conclusion, human nutrient sources account for up to about 30% of the available nutrients for algae to grow, more like 10 to 15% over widespread areas, and also significantly contribute to crab dissolution. Up to about 15% of the severity of crab dissolution could be attributed to the additional human nutrient sources. And as we just saw in the pteropods, also significantly contribute to adverse conditions for egg development, as well as other thresholds. And if there's time, I'd be happy to take questions. But while I wanted to show you one more thing, if there's time, because we did also do a bunch of scenarios for climate change, varying atmospheric CO2 levels. And what this animation is showing is from pre-industrial conditions of the year 1770 projected out to the year 2100, what the surface pH is predicted to be. The Salish Sea model prediction is on the right, and the global oceans are on the left, and they're both on the same color scale, so you can see that there's lower pH in the Salish Sea compared with much of the oceans. And the graph in the lower left shows the average pH for the Salish Sea, and the blue line that's on the bottom during that period of time, and then the green line is out in the ocean near where that red dot is, out just offshore from the Salish Sea. And then the orange line is the average for all of the world oceans. And we could just let this play over and over again, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions for Greg? Yep. Give it a minute.
About the maybe some probabilistic uncertainty analysis, like if you change some of the other parameters, how sensitivity was for pH? I mean, if there was uncertainty, let's say, in alkalinity or some other related parameter.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I didn't go over. Remember I said there was that website that had all those technical reports? Yeah, we do have really detailed, evaluation of the model skill and uncertainty that's there. For predicted pH differences, the models in general are much better and more accurate when you're taking differences between model runs, then you're looking at absolute values of the model run for a particular condition. And mostly what we're doing is taking differences, like we're seeing in most of the information that I showed here. And I hesitate to kind of give the number of what the uncertainty was for a difference in pH, but it was much lower than the differences that I'm showing on these maps. I don't want to say the wrong number because I don't actually remember the actual number, but it is much lower.
I'm curious if you could say a little bit more about the metric of the Dungeness megalope responding to gradients in pH in this dissolution of their carapaces, because I know a lot of organisms respond behaviorally to gradients, but this is the first I've heard of a dissolution of a skeleton basically responding to a gradient as opposed to an absolute value.
Yes, and I have to admit that I don't know the answer to that question. That's a really excellent question. The person who's leading that part of our project is Nina Bednarczyk, and she would be the one that would best answer that question. And I actually honestly don't know. That's just what the biological experts on our team have told me is the relationship, and I wish I did know the answer to tell you.
That's fair enough. Do you know whether they're from experiments or from observations in the field?
My understanding is it's based on an empirical relationship where there's been observations somewhere of some, of measures of crab dissolution and regression analysis, probably on what the pH gradients were associated with those samples. So I believe that's the case. But I don't know what if it's already been published or if it's still in preparation, to be honest with you.
Okay, so if it's from field data, it could be a correlation, not a causation. So that,
yeah, I
that
believe
makes sense.
It's a regression analysis, yeah.
Great, okay, thank you very much.
I just wondered, I'm not going to put you on the spot if you raise your hand, but does anyone in the room, sort of a crowdsourcing approach to that answer, does anyone in the room know more than the engineer up here on stage?
I'm an engineer.
I think we'll have to go elsewhere. Thank you. Thanks, Greg.